This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the Spectator's assistant editor. This week, we'll be discussing whether Turkey's President Erdogan is the most powerful man in Europe, what's next for Boris, and Leicester's fairy tale title win. First up, has Erdogan brought Europe to heel? In his Spectator cover piece, Douglas Murray argues that the Turkish president has used a mixture of intimidation, threats and blackmail to do just that and throw open the doors of Europe to Turkey. Douglas says Erdogan is a wretched Islamist bully who has shown just how the EU works. But in pushing Europe around, is Erdogan now more powerful than Merkel, Juncker and Cameron? I'm joined to discuss this by Rem Korteweg from the Centre for European Reform. So Douglas Murray argues in his cover piece that Erdogan is now the most powerful man in Europe. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think there's certainly a fair amount of truth to that. I wouldn't necessarily put him on the number one spot.
Who would you put as number one?
Well, Angela Merkel, I would say, still really takes the throne. But when it comes to key actors in the European political landscape, Erdogan is definitely there. And that, of course, has everything to do with the migration crisis and the crucial role that Turkey plays in enabling the EU to come to grips with the migration crisis. If you want to put it in those terms, Turkey can provide both the lock to, or putting a stop to the migration flows, but it can also be a spoiler. I mean, it can also decide to allow migrants to cross the Aegean or cross the land border with Bulgaria and putting pressure on the Europeans to get their act together.
Douglas talks in his piece of bad behaviour, but basically these are threats from Turkey to European Union countries that unless they give Turkey exactly what it wants on everything from arresting German comedians for being too rude to migration measures, Turkey will kick off, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And Erdogan knows that he has a very strong hand he can play. And that has everything to do with Europe's panicked response to the migration crisis, which is also related to Germany's decision to open its arms and to say, well, we're going to allow everyone to come to Europe.
So this wasn't inevitable. Even if the migration crisis itself was inevitable, this is a failing strategically on the part of European leaders.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure it's a failure as such, but it does position the EU in a very tricky position because it has so much political interest, so much riding on this deal with Turkey now that it can't be seen to lose. Just to remind you, last year, there were about 1.5 million illegal entries from Turkey into the European Union. There are still 2.5 million Syrians in Turkey who don't necessarily want to stay there and want to go to the EU. And at the same time, we see that the EU is frailing at the edges. Borders have been erected. There is a lot of inter-European, I would say, irritation about how do you deal with these amounts of refugees. So Turkey has a very crucial and a very strong position in this.
And do you see the growth of Turkey's influence as a bad thing? You sounded a little bit ambivalent when I talked about failings of European leaders.
Well, Turkey is a very important country. It's 75, 80 million people. It is positioned in between Europe and the Middle East. So that instability that we see in the Middle East could percolate through Turkey into the European Union. And therefore, it's crucial that the EU has good relations with Turkey. But one of the things that I think we're experiencing now in European politics is that the migration crisis is considered so dominant, so important, such a potentially existential issue for the future of the EU, that it is willing to pay the Turks a lot for their cooperation. And that's where you can make that argument that that strategy has failed. Or in my perspective, I think that the EU has overpaid. And you see Erdogan and the Turkish government really playing that hand to its advantage. And we saw in October of last year that an interim Abraham Agreement on the migration deal, the amount announced that the Europeans would pay to support refugee camps in Turkey amounted to 3 billion euros. But Erdogan simply said that's not enough. And he doubled the price, so to speak, and asked on top of that also a speeding up of the visa liberalization process, which is highly controversial, as well as a speeding up of the EU accession process. And so he has this, he knows that he has a strong hand to play, but he might also overplay it.
But as well as those big policy changes, he's also able, as we've already mentioned, to get some small but extraordinary concessions. So arresting a comedian. How has that happened?
I would not overdo that argument. But what Merkel effectively said, and she has been criticized heavily for this, both in Germany and as well as abroad, but what she effectively has said is that the matter of insulting a foreign leader is a matter for the courts. It's not something that she can decide or not decide to do. Formally speaking, of course, she is right. There is a law in Germany that prohibits the insulting of a foreign leader or however it's framed. But it was announced at a very sensitive time in which it seemed as if she was kowtowing to Ankara and was seen to take directions from Erdogan on this. Now, I think that the truth lies a little bit in the middle, and that she simply made a statement of fact and saying, well, if there is this consideration that he was indeed insulted, we have laws for that and we have a judicial system, and I, a politician, am not going to interfere in that.
Well, and Douglas argues in his piece that Erdogan has taken Turkey backwards and this is a modern tragedy. Do you agree with that assessment of the way he's governed domestically?
Absolutely. I think we need to take a broader historical perspective and also give Turkey credit from which point it came. So the EU accession process, or Turkey applied for EU membership back in the 1960s, and over the past 50 years, a number of very important reforms have been pushed through. Just to name one is that because of the pressure put on Turkey, the role of the military has decreased significantly. That's a gain. Also, in the early 2000s, a number of good steps were taken on the division of executive and legislative powers, but there has been tremendous backsliding under Erdogan. The role of the media is just but one which is very obvious. I mean, there isn't, I think Douglas also mentioned this in his piece, there is no country in the world where there are as many journalists in jail as in Turkey. The independence of the judiciary is highly questioned. And this is all part of Erdogan's plan to create a presidential political system with him at the top. And he hoped to have achieved that system after the November elections of last year, but it failed to give him the required parliamentary majority, which would allow him to change the constitution. And so you also see tensions now emerging within the government.
And how does the resignation of Davutoglu change things?
Well, I think this is highly momentous. In a way, Davutoglu has been the key mediator between Erdogan on the one hand and the European Union on the other. He is the person that Juncker and other commissioners have been doing this deal with. He's the person that Merkel talks to on a very regular basis. It's not Erdogan. Erdogan likes to sit on his perch on the Olympus, if you will, and give directions to Davutoglu. So I would say that with his resignation, at the moment, all bets are off as to the viability of the migration deal and where things go in the EU-Turkey relationship. A lot depended on his personal commitment, not only to be able to deliver, but also his ability to persuade Erdogan that this is a good thing. With the prime minister now out of the way and perhaps being replaced by potentially the son-in-law of President Erdogan, it remains to be seen how that interpersonal relationship between European leaders and the new prime minister will develop. It is also a sign that President Erdogan is increasing his claim on power, and that is worrisome in a variety of ways.
On to our second topic, the local and devolved election results. We now have the results from most of the counts across the country, and it hasn't been a great night for the Labour Party, save for its victory in London. Well, I'm now joined by our editor, Fraser Nelson, our political editor, James Forsyth, and Marcus Roberts from YouGov to discuss the aftermath of these results. James Forsyth first, Was this a terrible night for Labour? They didn't lose as many seats as some analysts had predicted.
That's a bit like saying that they didn't lose 7-0, so it was an all right performance for them. They are massively down on how they did in 2012 in terms of projected national share of the vote. That performance in 2012 led to an general election defeat 3 years later. This is the first time since 1985 that an opposition has failed to gain seats at council elections, and we all know what happened in 1987 general election. Labour got stuffed. I think these are very bad results for Labour. I think the Scotland result is particularly worrying for Labour, because Labour are now going to get squeezed out of Scottish politics, which is going to turn into a fight between a nationalist left and a unionist right. And if Labour is going to win without Scotland, that means, according to the pollsters, that it needs to be 13 points ahead in England. You know, that is a very difficult ask, even for a competent Labour leader, let alone Jeremy Corbyn.
But Fraser Nelson, wasn't this always going to be difficult for the Labour Party, particularly in Scotland, given its performance in the general election last year in Scotland?
Yeah, of course it was, yes. And let's remember that the official forecast from Rollings and Thrasher, which is as official as you can get, was 150 seats lost for Labour in England. That didn't happen. So this was not the cataclysm that Jeremy Corbyn's critics had feared, perhaps hoped for. But in Scotland, I have to say, there is no positive gloss the Labour Party can put on what is their worst election result there since 1918. To see the Conservatives come in second place is not a very healthy second place, is extraordinary. And yet again, you have to ask, is Scottish Labour going to go for its fourth leader in as many years? It's very difficult to see how they rebuild. And what was only a few years ago, a Scottish heartland for them. So I think it's a strange combination of results, but all told, it's not something that can depose Corbyn, especially not given that Sadiq Khan has won the mayoralty. I mean, the London prize was always going to be perhaps the biggest here, and it's been in Tory grasp for 8 years. Now it's in Labour hands. That is a significant victory, and a Labour mayor has now got the biggest, or one of the biggest, single personal mandates in the whole of Europe.
Marcus Roberts, what does this tell us about what will happen to Labour in the 2020 general election?
Well, there's the historical fallout from this, the political fallout from this, and the strategic fallout. On the history, James is quite right. This is only the third time since modern local government was invented in 1974 that an opposition party has failed to make ground in local elections. The other two instances being 1982 and 1985. So that's the history. The second is the politics. It is highly unlikely that there will be any kind of coup attempt against Jeremy Corbyn this summer as a consequence of these election results. It was always a bit of a stretch to imagine that the plotters were somehow going to maintain both the discipline and the momentum to remain silent between the local government election results and the European referendum, and only then act in July of this year against Jeremy Corbyn. That was always a bit of a stretch of the imagination, and that clearly is not going to happen at all after these results. Because Jeremy Corbyn and the leader's office can really thank their lucky stars for that Rawlings and Thrasher projection that said only 150 losses, and then to only end up with 20, 30 or 40 losses as a consequence. But finally, there's the strategic consequence of all of this. Labour is now stuck fighting multi-front wars in different countries of the United Kingdom. It's fighting against the SNP and the Tories in Scotland. It's fighting against Plaid and UKIP and the Conservatives in Wales. And now it's fighting against both UKIP and the Conservatives in England. In every part of the United Kingdom, the Labour Party has to look in too many different directions for its voters. And it's very confusing to see what the Labour Party could do strategically about that situation.
It means that a different message is required from Jeremy Corbyn for different parts of the UK, which is so difficult to do.
Or that most amazing of almost impossible things to imagine, a national leader with a politics so appealing and so powerful that it could actually unite the United Kingdom's politics once again.
It's interesting, Jeremy Corbyn tried his magic in Scotland, where they were anti-Trident in the manifesto, wanted to tax the rich more. So you did try the sort of left-wing card to play against a fairly left-wing SNP. I'm not sure whether the cataclysmic result for the Labour Party suggests that Scots aren't quite as left-wing right-wing, as they suggest, or whether it's simply that the apparatus is in such decay that the message is almost irrelevant.
James, surely Labour's moderates must be despairing right now, given that the results weren't as disappointing as they might have hoped.
The bad news for Labour moderates, I mean, the bad news for Labour Party is that these results are not bad enough to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, but they are bad enough to suggest that Labour is en route for not just for a defeat in 2020, but a very heavy defeat in 2020. I don't see what the obvious trigger now is, and nor do several of the plotters, for a revolt against Jeremy Corbyn, you know, barring a kind of shock by-election loss in Tooting or something like that. I think one of the other things that we've seen is that, that Jeremy Corbyn tends not to push things so far that he would precipitate a coup. So he is campaigning for the for Remain and the European Union referendum. He did suspend Ken Livingstone in the end. He did launch the inquiry into anti-Semitism. I don't think he's going to give the plotters the kind of obvious excuse that they want. I also thought Tom Watson's appearance on the radio this morning was very telling, because Tom Watson said, look, the one thing that Jeremy Corbyn and I agree very strongly on, which is revealing in and of itself, is that this needs to be a members-led party. And he then said, look, 8 months isn't long enough to make up our minds. I think what he was trying to say to Labour MPs is, look, you've got to wait, because we can't move until the membership have begun to see that Jeremy isn't an election winner. The problem is there are enough in these results from the social media universe for people to claim that Labour are doing much better than they are. People will say, look, it's Labour 31, the Tories on 30. Corbyn's Labour has beaten the Tories in the national share of the vote. So, oh, you know, it's only Blairites who are carping. I think that's the, what the worry for Labour is that this result just, is just going to make things carry on like that.
And there are no major elections on the horizon in 2017, in 2018, or right up until 2019 in Euro's times for a trigger event to occur that might precipitate a coup.
So is it the case, Marcus, that there's just no trigger event, or is it also the case that actually that the moderates are being a bit hopeless and they're never really going to get their act together, they don't have a proper strategy and they're completely at sea?
Well, asking the Parliamentary Labour Party to develop the kind of skills and backbone required to knife a leader in the back or the front would be asking it to do something it's never historically been capable of doing. Labour has always been very good at wounding, if not fatally wounding, its leaders, but not killing them and replacing them. And it could well come to 2020 to regret that decision even more than it regretted that decision in 2010, looking back at the decision to not move against Gordon Brown.
But has Labour ever in its history got rid of a bad leader?
It's not something the party does. The party believes in loyalty to the party first, last and always, even to the point of serious electoral consequence.
And finally, is Leicester's premiership title win really the fairy tale it's cracked up to be? Roger Alton says we've all had the wool pulled over our eyes, and he argues that Leicester are the biggest bunch of lump-it-long, kick-it-high players since Leeds in the 70s. But Nick Hilton is convinced that Leicester's triumph is the worst thing to have happened to football because it gives fans of middling teams hopes they would never have had otherwise. So what should we make of Leicester's win? I'm joined by Roger Alton and Nick Hilton now. So Nick, are we in danger of getting a bit carried away with Leicester's success?
Yeah, I think the collective we there is kind of telling, because I mean, I have no affiliation to Leicester. I'm not a fan of Leicester. I've never been to Leicester. I struggle putting it on a map. So yeah, it's an interesting thing that's happened. I can see why it's a news event, and I can see why people in Leicester are going a bit crazy, but I think we've gotten a little bit carried away.
But aren't you being a bit cold? Because surely it's the romance of the story of a team that wasn't expected to do anywhere near as well as it actually ended up doing.
I don't think the story is quite that romantic. I mean, yes, that is the kind of the narrative that we want to be told, and that's because, you know, football is built on this kind of collective delusion that you can win every match and you want to win every match. But I think that there is actually something underlying kind of the psychology of the football fan, which says that failure is the more important aspect of it. It teaches you about failure. It's like your grandparents dying teaches you about death.
Roger Alton, are you swept up in the romance?
A lot of what Nick says is absolutely right. I expect a lot of people in blue shirts to come calling around to his house quite soon, because no fans like being dissed like that. Though the basic part of the football fan is one of sort of grief and misery.
So this is a bad thing for Leicester then?
No, it's a very good thing for Leicester. But though next season they'll be lucky to finish in the top 10, I think. They'll have a Champions League run, which will be, I suspect, pretty catastrophic. But it's a brilliant thing for Leicester, but it's not going to get repeated. We'll have a huge impact on English football for the next 5 to 10 years in terms of fans' expectations, because fans will be saying to Crystal Palace or West Ham or Stoke, you know, look, I mean, Leicester can do it. they've had relatively low budget, but not that low, relatively low, and they've won the Premier League. Owners, rich owners, will be saying to their managers, "We're paying you an awful lot of money. We're paying you £2, £3, £4, £5 million a year. You go and win the Premier League. Ranieri won it on £500,000 a year last year. You go and do it, otherwise you're in big trouble." So I think there will be a lot of that will have a long term impact, but it's certainly not a fairy tale.
Do you think this does prove the point about money not being everything, or do you think ultimately it is still pretty important for most football clubs?
I mean, it's obviously important. It's about to get way more important with the new TV deal. But I think the conditions for Leicester winning haven't really been worked out yet. Exactly what went wrong for a number of clubs and why Leicester did particularly well. And this season, you know, people keep saying, Claudio Ranieri came out yesterday and said, it will, in the next 20 years, it's the rich clubs that will just dominate the league. But I don't really understand why it happened this season. So in that sense, for me to be like, it won't happen again is quite a lot. I think that for Leicester, it's maybe, you know, they've maybe peaked. But I think it has created a set of circumstances where no one quite understands why it happened. And because we can't fathom that, because there wasn't like an extraordinary surge of great players in Leicester, every team thinks, well, we've got the same conditions.
I think a lot of teams can learn from it, which is to do with, as you suggest, their team spirit rather than big stars. So they haven't had big stars. They've had very, very good players, but no big stars. Team spirit, pizza. You can't not like a story which has pizza in it in such a big scale.
Can you explain the pizza?
The pizza reference is that Ranieri, as an Italian, loves his pizza, and as a treat to his players, when they kept a clean sheet, he took them to Peter's Pizzeria in Leicester to learn how to make pizza. And there's lots of nice pictures of Mahrez tossing dough and all that kind of stuff. And it was a big bonding thing. Now he goes on about pizza a great deal, and good for him. I mean, I think you can define quite easily how they won, actually, which is that they scoured the French leagues for very cheap, very good players. And the French league is rubbish, apart from Paris Saint-Germain, which dominates. Everything else is very small audiences, low wages.
It's interesting the point you make about the kind of the pizza, not to hammer it home, but the team who are going to come second are Mauricio Pochettino's Tottenham, who are the absolute antithesis of this kind of ill-disciplined, kind of like relaxed and team spirit. Pochettino is a kind of taskmaster, much more kind of like someone like Jurgen Klopp or Marcelo Bielsa. So it does seem like the two most successful teams this season have been playing with different ideologies. And that, I think, makes it more inscrutable as kind of why these teams have done so well.
And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.